So I collected a few topics that have to do with proteins or polymers far from equilibrium, and I tried to somehow zoom in on stuff that happens close to surface, membranes, for example. So I think I'll be most interested in talking about the unfolding of the so-called von Willebrand factor in the blood under shear, which is important for blood coagulation, and I think that you'll talk more about it. So. And also I'll talk a little bit about the glycocalyx deformation, which is the polymer brush-like structure that is typically that you typically find on membrane surfaces. Now, what I'm interested in, what really intrigues me about these problems, is a coupling of hydrodynamic effects, elasticity of polymers or objects, plus thermal fluctuations. Really the merger of these three topics that I find interesting from a theoretical point of view, mostly because there's not so much stuff has been done on the connection, and also there are quite a number of interesting problems in biophysics. I'm not saying this is the most important subject or whatever, but I find it interesting for myself over the last years. So let me start with just to introduce you into this connection between elasticity, fluctuation, and hydrodynamics. Let me start with a very simple problem that's not biologically motivated or related. Let me start by talking about the sedimentation of an elastic rod. Now, the orientation of sedimenting rods can be measured quite elegantly using birefringence measurements. So what you do here is the following. You take a solution of rods, I mean, they can be viruses. You shine polarized lights through them. You observe the light under cross polarizers, and from the rotation of the light, you can infer, knowing the anisotropy of the polarizability of the molecule itself, you can infer the orientation, you know, the average orientation. You can say whether the molecule is oriented like this or like that. Okay. Now, there have been measurements by Konski, Zim, very long time ago on the TMV, on the tobacco mosaic virus. What they found was interesting. Now, all these viruses are charged. So in the normal condition, they put them in an electric field, they move in the electric field, and objects normally orient such that the direction of motion is parallel to the motion to the direction of the largest polarizability. For a rod-like charged object, the largest electric polarizability is along the long axis. Why? Because the counter ion cloud can be easily displaced. So normal birefringence means that you put such an object in an electric field, it will start moving and it will start orienting parallel to its direction of motion. Now, what they measured was for slightly elevated concentrations, a normal birefringence, meaning that the objects would orient perpendicular. And that was a surprise. And that's been seen in many systems. I just show you a second example, the FD virus. It's also rod-like. Shows as a function of the salt concentration and as a function of the virus concentration in the solution a region of the so-called normal birefringence and anormal. So what I want to talk about now is not this normal case, and I also don't want to talk today about the transition from normal to anormal. I want to talk about a hydrodynamic mechanism why a rod-like object would sediment or move in a perpendicular fashion, okay? Now, so my idea first was that this is due to some hydrodynamic effect. So let's talk a little bit about hydrodynamics in general. Yeah? Sure.
You have three boundaries, right? You have three regions, right? One no plus, no minus, one minus, one plus, right?
Sorry. This is plus, minus, and then? And this is nothing, that's where there are no experiments.
Oh, no experiments.
Yeah.
And below also no experiments?
No experiments, yeah. So all the science, they refer to experiments done by these people, and in Constance, in fact, and then I drew this line in green. Yeah? So the line, you could also draw it like this or like this. And yeah. There are two regions, and there's no mechanism for perpendicular orientation. Yeah? Well, there was none. I mean, we invented one. So hydrodynamics at low Reynolds numbers. So that's the Navier-Stokes equation. So we have the viscous term, pressure term, and the inertia term. Now, as you know, and we had a talk on this stuff yesterday, if the Reynolds number, which you get by getting all the prefactors on the right side, dividing by the prefactors on the left side, if this Reynolds number is much smaller than 1, then of course you can neglect this inertia term, and the equation becomes linear, and therefore much simpler. Now let's put in some numbers. If a human swims, viscosity of water, density of water, velocity of the order, let's say, of 1 meter per second, length of the order of 1 meter, you get a Reynolds number of 10 to the 6, so large. And in this case, you're not allowed to neglect the right side. Yeah, so this would correspond to all hydrodynamics at macroscopic length scales. Now, if we put in typical velocities and typical length scales of bacteria, or let's say of nano objects, then we come up with Reynolds numbers that are much smaller, 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 7, and then it's okay to neglect the right side. This, of course, is very nice because linear equations are much simpler to work with than nonlinear equations, and we can get exact solutions. And I will tell you a little bit more about how we solve the Stokes equation on the computer in a second. Now let's go back to this problem of the sedimenting cylinder. Now, could it be just that within Stokes' equation, there is a tendency for a cylinder, when it moves, to orient perpendicularly? That's what I first thought, and was motivated by the observation that the mobility itself is different for the two different orientations. Namely, the cylinder that is moving parallel to its orientation moves twice, roughly, as fast as a cylinder that moves perpendicularly. So this is fast. So my first feeling was, okay, this is fast, so maybe it will orient like this, and then it will get stuck in this perpendicular orientation. That is not true at all. You can look it up in Brenner Appel's book and classical textbooks. And in their way of writing down, it's formulated like this. For an orthotropic body, is a body with three perpendicular planes of symmetry, like a cylinder. So you have this plane, that plane. So for an orthotropic body, if you look at the coupling equation between force acting on the body, torque acting on the body, and translational velocity u, and rotational velocity omega, you see that for this highly symmetric body, the coupling terms vanish. That means if you sediment a body, if you have a force F acting on this body, there's no coupling to rotation. You only inflict a translational velocity on the body, and vice versa. That means if you take a body which might be oriented at any angle, and you let it sediment, it moves down, it will not start rotating, not due to hydrodynamics. It might move in a slanted direction, and it will, in fact, it will move sidewards, but it will not orient in any given orientation.
There will be no boundaries.
All this is without boundaries. Yes. Uh-huh. It will, of course. I mean, that's a good observation. I mean, that's an important remark. This changes, of course, when you have boundaries. Yeah? Boundaries will, in fact, exert torques on moving bodies. Yes.
Actually, there's a beautiful video by J.I. Taylor, where he showed you what you're saying, but he has
The slanting.
Yeah, I think.
Yes. And you can easily do it yourself if you take some metal bar and you put it in glycerin, then it's a nice experiment. However, if you break one of the symmetries, so if I take this orthotropic body, let's say I don't break the stick, but I break a symmetry, let me do it. So if I bend it, in this case, this coupling tends to become non-zero. And in this case, there will be a coupling between sedimentation, that means translation, and orientation. So let me next, so what I want to introduce you to now is a simulation method for simulating hydrodynamics on the computer. And again, what you start with is, and we had a similar equation yesterday in Petya's talk, what we start with is the Green's function for the Stokes equation. So let me go through this for a minute. So if we have a point force acting on a liquid, let's say it acts in the vertically up then of course we can solve the Stokes equation, and the solution for the situation, that is called the Green's function. This Green's function is called the Osen tensor, it's written down here, and here what I show here are the streamlines. These are the velocity streamlines of the solvent if you have a force acting at the origin. Now what is important here, first of all, that these streamlines, they move in this fashion, backwards they move towards the object, in front they move away. What is also important is the 1 over r factor. So the solvent velocity is very long ranged. That means the force, that this force will exert on any other particle that is nearby, this force decays like 1 over r. It's more slowly decaying than the electric force, which decays like 1 over r squared. So in many cases, you have to take these hydrodynamic effects into account if you're interested in situations far from equilibrium. At equilibrium, of course, all these effects, they vanish. Now, it's a Stokes equation is linear. That means also the superposition principle is valid. So if you have now many forces acting in your system, you can just add up all these Osen tensors, and you still have a solution to the Stokes equation. That is nice. And that's written down here. So this would be the solvent velocity resulting from many forces acting on the fluid. And of course, you can turn it around. If you have a given solvent flow, a prescribed solvent flow distribution, you can invert the problem and calculate back the force you would need to generate the solvent flow distribution. Now, in a simulation, it is important to realize that, in fact, the no-slip boundary condition, if you're talking about polymers, if you talk about spherical objects that you produce or that are made up of small spheres, the no-slip bounding condition is automatically satisfied, and it can be easily seen. If you now have many particles, the velocity of, let's say, the jth particle within this Osen tensor Green's function approach can be split into the velocity, the solvent velocity due to other particles that are moved, plus the velocity of the particle due to a force acting on itself, which together will give the solvent velocity at the particle position. Yeah, so this, by the way, this you could call it Faxon's law. It's a reformulation of Faxon's law. That means that if I want to simulate a protein, I can always build this from beads in the simulation. I would have cohesive forces inside this protein, and within a stationary situation, let's say when this protein is moving with a constant velocity, these cohesive forces in the simulation would adjust such that the solvent velocity inside stagnates. Yeah? If it didn't, you would have relative velocities inside the protein, which would again readjust. Yeah? So it's basically a way of automatically solving solvent boundary problems. Yeah? Now, I did two things now. I introduced you to hydrodynamics. We talked a little bit about elastic forces, and there were many talks already yesterday on elasticity. What we next need is thermal noise, because I'm interested in the combined action of these three factors. And then we do within a Langevin equation, and in fact, Marcos yesterday, he showed you the Langevin equation and explained it a little bit. Let me go through it again. So this, let's say, is Newton's law, acceleration, force acting on a particle, friction effects. In fact, in our simulations, we typically neglect the mass term altogether, which somehow makes sense because we neglected inertia effects in the hydrodynamics to start with. Yeah? So it is somewhat consistent. But what we add here is now a noise term, and that is crucial in the Langevin description. The force typically can be obtained in a deterministic way from a potential plus, if you drive the system, let's say by shear, electric forces, you would add non-conservative forces also in here. Now what is important is that this random force that we add here is correlated. And it's correlated, it means the two-point correlator, is proportional to the mobility matrix. The mobility matrix, so that's the stuff that couples the force acting on one particle with the motion of the other particle. Again, this is due to hydrodynamics. So in the mu, all the Osen tensors are included. Let me go through the explanation then. Yeah? There's a good chance that I will answer your question. This correlator has to be proportional to the mobility matrix. And this way ensures that if you look at equilibrium properties of the Lajoie equation, which is equivalent to solving the adjoint Smoluchowski equation, that in equilibrium, the distribution you get satisfies the Boltzmann statistics. Yeah? If you didn't color the noise correctly in the simulation, you would not get correct Boltzmann statistics in equilibrium. Now, the step you do here, and this was done in the 70s, so this is an old story, so the step that drives you away from equilibrium is basically any force, any driving force that you add into this force vector. Yeah. Again, that could be shear electric force or anything. So this is the technique we'll be using. Yeah. So this is a simulation technique that includes hydrodynamics via the mobility matrix. It's solvent free, so we don't model the water, and we do this not because we are lazy, of course we are lazy, but the problems we try to attack, they're too costly if you did MD simulation with all the water included. We also do MD simulations far away from equilibrium for simple cases, but for the stuff I'm going to show today, this would not work because you don't reach the necessary time scales. Yeah? So, okay. The U, and anything that's not conservative, I would put into here.
So
yeah.
You couple, what justifies it?
Not much, honestly. Yeah. Also, if you think about this whole Langevin equation approach, I mean, ideally you would like to somehow derive this from, let's say, a Hamiltonian. I mean, people tried this in the 60s. The name that comes to my mind is Lebovitz. You don't get very far because it gets very messy, very complicated. Let me point out a few other things that are not justified. The simple form of the noise, which has no memory but acts instantaneously, of course, this is only valid if you look at timescales that are much larger than all the relaxation times in your system. What else? The hydrodynamic interaction, the Ozean, that's also, of course, a large distance approximation. Yeah, so you could try to do better by going from the Ozean to the Rottner-Prager formalism. What else? Yeah. So there are many things. So it is ad hoc. Yeah. And I think that's the fair way to introduce this. And what you get at the end is, again, in equilibrium, you get Boltzmann. So by solving this equation on the computer and by sampling over trajectories, you at the end, in equilibrium, get Boltzmann statistics. And there's some, let's say, belief in that if you drive your system away from equilibrium, you still get sensible results. Yeah,
One question.
Sure.
The final comment that you write there,
by integrating out over the random force. Okay, that's a quite standard derivation of going from a stochastic equation to the deterministic equation that somehow describes the time evolution of distribution functions. Yeah, I can tell you a few books where you can read about this. Yeah, and you can also go back from the Smoluchowski or Fokker-Planck. You can also go to a path integral formulation, mm-hmm. then from the path integral go to a stochastic. Yeah, so they're all equivalent. On the computer, this is somehow faster or easier to implement, I would say. Okay? Yes?
You put the noise of the Langevin equation to the particles, but not to the flow fields. Would that make a difference?
Well, the flow field and the particles, they are basically coupled. Yeah, so there's no difference. If you calculate from the particle motion the flow field, there's a one-to-one mapping. Yeah, so there's no difference really. Yeah, so the coupling comes because of the finite self-mobility of the particle.
Well,
yeah?
The field in between that would also fluctuate. It's like a second or first quantization.
Oh, okay. So that's also good. Yeah. So I should say this, of course, the fluctuations of the solvent particle, that's also neglected. Yeah? That's neglected. Okay. Absolutely. And of course, this probably doesn't make sense if you look at motion of particles that have the same size as the solvent particles. Mm-hmm. Okay, so as you see, so there are many things that you can question. So let's look at a few results. So let's start, let's go back now to the problem, sedimenting rod. So this is a simulation Xava, my PhD student, did. So he starts now a simulation of a rod, sedimenting rod, at an initial angle of, let's say, 45 degrees. The rod will move down. In the movie, the camera follows the rod. So what happens? So it's fluctuating, it's bending, and it's orienting perpendicularly to the direction of motion. So let's try to understand this. Yeah. So again, I mean, it is now bent. The symmetry is broken, and the rod is also oriented in a perpendicular fashion, as you see it in anomalous birefringence. So let's try to understand this in simple ways. So when we start the simulation, when Xaver starts it, he has direct forces acting on the cylinder. So this could be gravitational or electric field. Now, the effective forces, the total force acting on the monomers, consists of the direct forces plus the hydrodynamic forces. That means the forces that come from nearby particles that are mediated by the moving solvent. Clearly, a particle in the middle, a monomer in the middle, receives this pushing force from both sides. So the effective force on the middle will be larger than at the ends. At the ends, you only have this hydrodynamic pushing force from one side. That means you get a non-constant force profile in a stationary situation. When this rod is moving at constant velocities, all of its part will move at constant velocity. That means there must be something that is counteracting this force profile. And this can only be an elastic force profile. That means the rod will bend such that the total force, which comes from adding elastic force plus hydrodynamic force, will be constant. And that gives you this deformation or elastic, this gives you this elastic deformation.
Isn't it the same as taking a rope and let it relax on gravity? And you have the chain?
Well, except that this is a local problem, yeah? But it shares,
but
yeah,
gravity,
I mean...
Gravity is everywhere.
Yes, but the rope, of course, it's not, I mean, in the rope you don't have long-range interactions due to a solvent. That yeah. In the rope, so you're talking about the let's say you're talking about the balance of elastic plus gravitational forces. Yeah? Here it's a little bit different. Yeah, because it is really the solvent flow that is pushing the middle. Yeah? And this again, it's 1/r. It's very long range. So at the end you get a deformed rod, the coupling tensor is non-zero, and there is now a coupling between the translation, the force that pushes it down, and the orientation, meaning that in fact this thing will be perpendicular. Yeah. So this is one example of the coupling between hydrodynamics, elasticity, and fluctuations. So let me skip this and come now to the bio problem, the shear-induced denaturation of the protein, the so-called von Willebrand factor. So let's look a little bit at the immune response to a cut in a artery or vessel surface. So what happens is, so here's blood, it's flowing. Let's assume here is some small cut, a bruise or something, doesn't need to be drastic. So what happens? Now, the body produces a protein called the von Willebrand factor, which is globular in its normal state, and it's very big. I'll tell you a little bit more about it in a second. Now, as a response to cut, you have these vesicles that are in the intracellular space beneath the endothelial cells. So these vesicles, as a response, dock to the vessel surface and release the content into the bloodstream. It is believed, and so this is what I read in review article, it's believed that once these globular, almost spherical proteins are released into the bloodstream, they unfold, form very long fibers that then mediate the second reaction, the docking or binding of platelets. I hope I somehow sketched it correctly. Huh? So first you have these von Willebrand factors, these guys, they somehow unfold, they bind to the collagen on the cell surface. They have binding sites for platelets. You, in the second step, you get the platelets adsorbed. In the third step, you get fibrin, and so on and so forth. So if you don't have, yeah?
How does the vesicles move through the endothelial tissue?
Say again?
How does the vesicles move through the endothelial tissue?
I don't think anybody knows. I mean, the von Willebrand effect, there's very little known about it. I'll show
so
you some...
They move the interstices of the...
That's what I read in a regular article.
They have to break the junction, which is really strong.
I don't know. Yeah? Okay, now let me one knows a little bit about the structure of the von Willebrand factor. So it's a huge protein. It consists of a monomer. Monomers consist of 2,500 amino acids. They form dimers. And these dimers then bind to form multimers, a few hundreds. So this is a very big protein. And it's water soluble in the globular state. It's in fact the biggest soluble protein in the body. So one question which I will try to answer is, why is it so big? Yeah. Why can nature do the same thing with a small protein?
Can you say big in nanometers or so, like how big is this actually?
Nanometers, okay, look, I mean, we can plug it in. I mean, 2,500, so let's say the bond length is a third of a nanometer, so this would make one monomer, if you straighten it out, let's say we straighten it out. Then it is a micrometer. If you close pack a monomer, then it's, let's say, 10 nanometers, if you close pack it. Now, whether the monomer, in fact, itself unfolds or not, this is also not so clear, I would say. People know from AFM studies, if you take a monomer and you put it on a mildly hydrophobic surface, then it in fact flattens out. It wets the surface. Yeah? So the forces, apparently, that keep the monomer together are very weak. Yeah? So I would believe that by pulling on it and with an AFM, you could straighten it out. And I would also believe that it partially straightens out in shear flow. Not so. Okay, so these are some pictures obtained by a guy called Schneider. He's a doctor. He's in the medical department in Munich. So these are pictures of the von Willebrand factor adsorbed on endothelial cell surfaces. I don't know how he obtained these pictures. Yes, but you see that you have these long fibers. Scale is a few micrometers. I mean, 50 micrometers, sorry. These are experiments done by Wixford. That's a different Schneider, it's the brother, in fact. Done in Augsburg, and they study this protein in a microflow chamber. Let me try to explain it in a few words to you. So this microflow chamber works with surface acoustic waves. Yeah, so you have a piezo transducer which ripples the surface. They also have a hydrophobic surface, and they put a ring, a hydrophilic ring on the surface. So when they take this protein solution in water, they can spread it on the ring, and it forms a ring, a canal, which is stable for hours in some humid atmosphere. Now, if they turn on this transducer, you produce flow and thus enormous shear flows in this very small canal, yeah, which has only a volume of a few microliters. So the shear rates you can achieve in this ring are of the order of 10,000 hertz. And that's, of course, a nice system for studying this. Simultaneously, you can observe fluorescently labels proteins from the bottom or from the top. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay, so now I show you some pictures that the two Schneiders obtained. And this was, these are pictures taken in this microfluidic chamber of this von Willebrand factor without shear. It's fluorescently labeled, so you see it's globular. And with shear. In this case, there is a collagen matrix on the surface. So you see that this von Willebrand factor absorbs, straightens out, forms fibrils, and then absorbs on the surface. This is not really what I'm interested in. Also functionality tests, so it is good for absorbing platelets. That's important for the medical applications.
So do they follow the collagen orientation? Because the collagen tends to orient,
right? I mean, look, this looks funny because it almost looks like a hexagonal or honeycomb pattern. No. That's what I asked them, and they don't know, because they don't really know the pattern of the collagen on the surface. No. I don't know.
And how do you know that they get stretched, but not simply polarized from that?
I guess in the surface state, they don't know. Yeah. Let me move on now to the experiment that I would like to describe a little bit. Now, what about in the next experiment? They produce the surface such that there's no collagen, and the von Willebrand factor does not adsorb on it. Now it's really in bulk, and it's floating, and it's solubilized, and so on and so forth. In this case, in fact, they see that as a function of this shear, you also go, even in the bulk, from collapsed state to a stretched state. Now how do they know that?
But that's not okay.
No, I think they did one experiment to check this, because they relaxed it. So once it's unfolded in the shear, they turn off the shear, and then they see that it relaxes back within, let's say, 100 microseconds, and they can turn on, turn off, and they see, they can watch a single protein, how it unfolds, folds, unfolds in many cycles. I think this is answers your question. Okay. And this would be, in fact, the stretching or the end-to-end distance, the size of this protein as a function of the shear rate, and you see that there is a transition which is quite sharp at of something like 3,000 hertz. So this is what I want to understand, and this is what I will describe in the next 10 minutes or so. And this is work that was done by my postdoc, Alfredo Alexander Katz. Okay, so what we started out is, again, the simulation tool, yeah, this hydrodynamic simulation that adds elasticity and fluctuations. And first, Alfredo produced a collapsed polymer. So that's easy. So we took a flexible polymer, a short polymer consisting of 50 monomers. I guess a monomer for us means a von Willebrand monomer. So then we add some attractive interactions, and if the interaction strength epsilon is large enough, this thing will form a globule, like a collapsed protein, whatever. So having this thing now, we subject this now to shear flow. Let me show you a movie that Alfredo produced. This is shear flow, which is slightly above the critical shear flow. So what you see is, first of all, it's rotating, somewhat tumbling a little bit, and then from time to time, there are these unfolding events, which always start with a single piece of polymer sticking out from the rotating globule. Yeah? So it doesn't seem like this is working via a deformation of the globule, like a coarse grain or harmonic deviation from the spherical shape. It looks more like there is something going on the polymeric scale. And that's what we try to understand and to model. Now, from the simulation, of course, we get the stretching, the radius, as a function of the shear rate. And here are different simulation data. The white symbols, this is without hydrodynamics. That's a freely draining case where we turn off hydrodynamic interactions. The black data points are with hydrodynamic interactions. And these simulations are very time-consuming. They're difficult to obtain, to do. And the black squares, this is the experiment. So this is how in the experiment, the actual von Willebrand factor abruptly opens and increases its stretching radius. Of course, the experiment that is that's plotted on a different scale for the shear rate. Now, if we collect these transitions, so you see that there is something like a critical shear for unfolding. If we collect these critical shear rates, we can get from the simulation the dependence on the size and on the cohesive force in the globule. And this is what we like to understand. And let me first now introduce you to you a simple scaling model where we try to understand this critical shear rate as a function of the size of the globule and as a function of the cohesive force. And this is a scaling mechanism that is induced by single chain excitations. Because that's what we believe drives this transition. That's what we see from the movie in the simulations. Now let's start out by picturing we have a sphere in shear flow, so the sphere will rotate, and let's say we have an excitation, that means a protrusion of length L. Protrusion means it's a spontaneous end of a polymer that sticks out. Now, the cohesive force on this protrusion, that means the force that is trying to pull it back into the globule, will somehow scale with the length of this protrusion, and not knowing much about the interactions, we assume it to scale like some power, alpha. Now clearly, if we have a sharp interface, then we would of course assume that this force that pulls it back in does not depend on the length. Yeah? If the interface is rough or diffuse, then there will be independence. So that's a free parameter, alpha. Now believing that the typical protrusion length is similar to the equilibrium distribution, we can use the equipartition theorem. And again, that's something you could argue against, because we are looking at a non-equilibrium situation. But if we believe that the equipartition theorem is valid, then from this force law, you get a typical protrusion length. Yeah, that means that would be the typical length of polymer that sticks out if you include thermal fluctuations, and plugging this back into this protrusion force, we get the typical protrusion force that is acting on a typical protrusion that is sticking out. So this is what pulls it back in. So what pulls the polymer out? And that is, of course, the shear. Now, the simple case is if we neglect hydrodynamics, freely draining, so in this case, you would have slip at the surface. In this case, it's quite easy to see that the shear force, the force that pulls the protrusion out, is proportional to the relative velocity between sphere and solvent, that is shear rate times the radius. It's proportional to the number of monomers, to the length, and it's proportional to the friction coefficient of one monomer. So this would be the shear force. By balancing the two forces, the shear and this protrusion and this cohesive force, you would get a critical length, or you would get a critical shear for pulling the polymer out from the globule. Now, if we include hydrodynamics, that means if there's no slip on the surface, the argument is is more complicated. Because in this case, if the protrusion is very small, there is no slip. That means there is no force. There is no shear force acting on the polymer. And in fact, the force that the monomer experiences depends on the distance. So therefore, the total force acting on the protrusion you obtain by integrating over the force acting on each monomer along the protrusion contour. And that's not so difficult because there is an exact solution for the Stokes equation of a sphere in a shear flow. And if you plug it in and you integrate, you calculate the total shear force acting on the protrusion, you get a very different dependence on the length L and on the radius. So here, in the free draining case, the shear force scales with the radius. In the hydrodynamic case, it scales like radius to the minus one. Now by balancing the shear force and the cohesive force, we get critical shear rates, which again scale differently in the free draining case. In this case, the critical shear rate goes down with the radius of the globule. In the hydrodynamic case, and that's of course experimentally relevant, it scales with the radius. So in this case, having a larger protein brings down the critical shear rate. In the true case, having a large polymer, a large globule, brings the critical shear rate up. Now let's do one more thing. Well, first of all, these two scaling laws, they agree quite nicely, I would say, with the simulation data. So this is the simulation data on the critical shear rate without hydrodynamics. This is with, and you notice that the dependence on the radius is different in both cases. Yeah? The dependence on the alpha on this exponent that characterizes the interface, we don't fully understand, so I don't want to talk about it so much. Let me talk about one more thing. Let's now plug in. So this is the time scale of a monomer itself. So that is the time that a monomer needs to diffuse by its own radius. So if we plug in actual units, we see that the critical shear rate scales like the volume, n to the 1/3, divided by the monomer size to the 3rd power. So there is a small dependence on the actual size or length of the protein. There's a huge dependence on the monomer size. And if we plug in numbers, assuming for the cohesive energy per monomer 2 kBT, length, or that means monomer number 100, critical shear rate of 1,000, which you have in blood vessels, the monomer size you come out by putting also in the numerical prefactors is 10 nanometers. So again, let me invert the problem. If nature had to invent a protein that unfolds at shear rates of 1,000, which is typical in arterioles, in small vessels, then it cannot play a lot with the total size n because the dependence is very small. It would rather play with the monomer size because that enters cubic. And that might explain, let me express this very carefully, that might explain why the von Willebrand factor is so large, yeah, in terms of monomer size. Yeah. There might be other factors, yeah, but that's... That would be our conclusion based on the simplistic model. Okay, so I talked about the unfolding of collapsed polymers in shear. Let me at the end talk a little bit about the glycocalyx and what we find interesting in these objects. Now, first of all, glycocalyx, that is a brush-like polymer layer that is attached to many membranes. these are typically, I guess, glycoprotein. These are polymers consisting of glycoproteins, right? And
glycosaminoglycans is a very long disaccharide polymer.
So these are hydrophilic.
Very negatively charged.
Uh-huh,
by
okay. So these are, they form polymers that are, I mean, these are polymers that are solubilized, so they stick out from the surface, and they form layers that are up to, I guess, 50 nanometers, something like this.
Much larger.
Larger.
500 nanometers.
Okay. Now, in some sense, this glycocalyx stabilizes the outer leaflet of cell surface, also important for lateral interactions, and it's believed, or I guess it's known, that it controls the viscosity in this layer itself. And of course, you have to imagine that everything that goes into this cell has to go through this layer. So understanding the kinetics in this layer, I think, is important. So what we first did is, again, we used the same effect that you have shears, that you have shear flow in blood. So we were interested in how this glycocalyx layer changes its structure as a function of an applied shear flow. This work done by my ex-postdoc, Yeon-Bun Kim, who's in Santa Barbara now, in fact. So what he did is he constructed a artificial glycocalyx by, in fact, attaching a semi-flexible polymer model. I mean, this is what I show here. You also looked at flexible polymer models, but this is a quite stiff polymer. He put many of these polymers in an array. He implemented lateral periodic boundary conditions on the interactions and on the hydrodynamic flow. So we really somehow model an infinite carpet of these polymers. And then he put on a shear flow. Now, the actual numbers he used are quite large, 10 to the 7. This is far from the experimental values. What is really important here is always the shear flow times the typical relaxation time of the polymer. And since we use short polymers, the product of the relaxation time of the polymer times the shear rate, this is close to what you have in experiments. Okay, so I mean, don't take this number too seriously. So let's see what you obtain. So this is for this polymer length, for this stiffness, a mild shear rate, and you see that these polymers, they fluctuate, thermal noise, they bend, elasticity, and they go with the shear. Yeah? So hydrodynamic coupling. If the shear rate is larger, this is shown here, then of course the bending is larger. What you notice that the actual height of the brush layer depends on the shear rate, and therefore the back effect on the flow depends on the shear rate also, and on the elasticity, and also on the grafting density of polymers. Yeah? So in this case, of course, the shear will penetrate much closer to the surface than in this example. Yeah? And within the simulation code, one could, of course, simulate everything together in a self-consistently coupled fashion. Yeah? So you have the typical shape or the conformation of the polymers, which is coupled to the flow on the Stokes level again. Yeah? So this is, in fact, the fluid velocity that he calculates as a function of the distance from the surface. As the stiffness increases, so the red is very flexible, and you see that the flow penetrates almost down to the surface. The purple polymer is very stiff, and here you see that the flow does not penetrate so deeply towards the surface. Here, wound played with the shear rate, and you see that as the shear rate decreases, as you go from the purple to this light blue, in fact, the stagnation length, that means the distance between the shear field and the surface, increases. The wall here we implement by using the Blake-Strings function. Yeah. So the Blake-Strings function, I think, Petia, she in fact derived almost the Blake's function yesterday. Yeah. So it takes into account the image Stokes, the doublet, the Stokes doublet, and the source. Source doublet. Yeah, source doublet. And that basically satisfies the no slip boundary condition on the surface. Okay, so let me compare this with an experiment that was done by people in Leipzig. So what they did is the following: they took a sphere, they grafted a DNA layer onto it, they subjected this sphere to shear flow, and they measured the force acting. They basically measured the force they needed to apply to the sphere in order to hold it stationary at a point, which of course is easy to do in a laser trap experiment. And then they looked at the calculated hydrodynamic radius as a function of the fluid velocity. And what you see is that depending on the solid condition, depending on the length of the grafted DNA, what you see is that the hydrodynamic radius goes down, which of course tells you that as you increase the shear rate, these DNA polymers deform, they move closer to the surface, and therefore the effective hydrodynamic radius of this object goes down. Yeah, so I'm sure this has been seen before, but this stated last year, and we compared it with our simulation. The comparison is okay. I mean, of course, it would be nice in the next step to do similar experiments or to learn more about the glycocalyx structure as a function of the shear, and of course then to look at other physical properties. And one thing we discussed is of course diffusion of particles. How fast does a particle of a certain size, it could be a protein, nutrient, it could be a virus or something else, how fast does it diffuse from the blood volume towards the surface as a function of the applied shear stress, and how is this physiologically relevant? Yeah, this is something we are interested in.
Yeah.
Question?
Is it relevant to ask how this depends on the grafting density of your polymers on the surface?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, I mean, Wu looked at it. He hasn't written up the paper, but it's a little bit like what you would expect. If they're very sparse, if you have mushrooms, then of course flow can penetrate. As soon as the lateral distance is of the order of the height, then you have hydrodynamic screening, and from the hydrodynamic point of view, not much changes. But if you move them much closer, then they interact. Then you have direct interactions between monomers, which of course could be attractive or repulsive. I guess for the glycocalyx, it's quite repulsive, and that means that the glycocalyx is in good solvent condition. But you know, you can play with it. Yeah? I mean, this might be a way of producing surface coatings that are responsive to applied shear in one or the other way. I don't know. Okay, so I want to stop, since I'm now the chair, I want to stop in time, and only show you one last example, which is not, I mean, it's not, so this is not understanding experiments, this is somehow dreaming or making funny models. You know, of course, that in biology that there are ciliae that perform the function of moving objects through high viscous fluids or to pump in internal organs, to pump high viscosity fluids through tube-like organs. And the way cilia do it is they stroke back and forth in an ordered fashion, thereby pumping effectively fluid from one side to the other. So cilia, to be clear about this, cilia do this with internal motors, dynein motors, which have a different shape, different response in the power stroke and in the recovery stroke. You see that the shapes of the polymer in the two strokes are very different. And this, of course, is crucial. Now, Woon, he designed an artificial cilia model where he takes an elastic polymer, graft it to a surface, and he moves this polymer only by a torque acting at the base. Otherwise, this polymer is symmetric and it's elastic. So what you see is, in this example, that if the strokes, the forward and backward strokes, are different, there's also an asymmetry in shape of the polymer in the forward and in the backward action. And it's clearly this asymmetry which is important for pumping. Because if the torques were the same, you would move to the right, you would move to the left, you would pump in the two strokes the same amount to the left, to the right. That means the net action would be zero. And this is not good. Now, Woon, he defined a pumping efficiency by the net solvent velocity far away from the surface divided by the power you put in. Yeah, of course, I mean, high efficiency would mean you pump a lot without investing too much energy. Most of the energy is dissipated, so it heats the solvent and doesn't pump. And you clearly want to maximize this. And that's what he did. So he looked at the important parameters, and you looked at the maximum of this efficiency as a function of these parameters. And of course, there's one condition we can immediately grasp by scaling. Because if the stick is too stiff, then it would not deform at all. Let's say it's infinitely stiff and infinitely stiff, and you would move it very quickly to the right, slowly to the left. Still, it would be a so-called reciprocal motion because the Stokes equation is linear. And again, although the velocities are different, backward, forward, the net pumping action would be zero because of the linearity of the Stokes equation. You can simply integrate it out. So that means that in order to pump with this simple device, you need deformation. Elasticity is important because if you don't add elasticity, no pumping is achieved. Elasticity means that the torque divided by kVt should be of the order of the persistence length divided by the total length of the filament. The second condition would be asymmetry. Again, if you have an elastic object, it would deform. If the torques are the same, the shape would be the same and no pumping action would occur. Now here, Woon looked at this pumping efficiency as a function of the ratio of the forward-backward torques and as a function of this ratio of the persistence length, which is a measure of the bending rigidity, divided by the contour length. White means efficient, black means not efficient. And there's clearly a maximum which occurs at the ratio of the forward-backward torques of about 3 and as a ratio of the persistence length divided by the total length of the order of 10 to the 4. By the way, 10 to the 4 is quite similar to what you find in some of these cilia, biological cilia molecules. But again, the mechanism there is very different. So it would mean that if you could produce such a machine, and of course we are thinking about how you could do it, I mean, one way would be to optically drive the system, for example, by taking stiff polymers, bind them to surfaces, and then connect hinges that, for example, consist of azobenzene molecules, which you can optically switch from a long version to a short version. Yeah, so this is, in principle, doable, whether it makes sense and whether somebody will do it, I don't know. So that's our contribution to the world of nanomachines. So let me stop now. Skip all this stuff. Okay, I don't have to go through it. So So what I try to convince you of is that at the merger of hydrodynamics, fluctuations, which are important in the nano world, and elasticity, any biological object is deformable. There are some interesting results which are fun to work with theoretically, and I hope that they also have some bearing on experimental work. Thank you.